There's not a version of myself that I can imagine without the impact that Audre Lorde has had on my life.
Hello, and welcome to The Feminist Present, the podcast where we use the gift of feminism to figure out what's going on right now. I'm Adrian Dobb.
I'm Laura Good. We did it. That was like the cleanest intro we've done in months.
I know. First take two.
That's what they call him. First take Adrian. We have such a delightful conversation with Alexis Pauline Gumbs about her incredible, I mean, it's to call it an Audre Lorde biography doesn't even really encompass it. It's like a biomythography, but the book is called Survival as a Promise, The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. But perhaps before we get to that, we might have like some other book news to talk about.
Yes.
Adrian, what's going on in your book life? She asked conspicuously.
Yes. So for people who have been tuning into the podcast, you know the spiel. I have a book coming out on September 24th. It's called The Cancel Culture Panic, and I would beg you to pre-order it. Apparently, it's a big deal. I don't quite understand it, but I want those sweet, sweet pre-orders.
You sure do.
It's good. I promise. It's good. And it's affordable.
It is good.
It's an affordable book. I have, I should show this off. I have here the, believe the first copy in existence. This,
I hadn't seen the cover yet. Wait, hold it up so I can see it. I really like that cover.
It's a gorgeous cover.
You like it too? Because authors don't always like, that's wonderful.
No, I love it. I took one look at it. This is the first, whoever the designer was, first crack. And I'm like, this is dynamite.
That never happens. You have no idea how lucky you are.
There was a second version that like had a good idea, but like wasn't as good. But like this was the first one they sent me, and
it
was
fantastic.
No, it's true. I mean, they modeled it a little bit on the cover of my tech book, What Tech Calls Thinking, and so like they knew I liked. They knew I was happy with that cover, so tried to harken back to it. So they weren't sort of, it wasn't sort of a blind stab, but I was totally, totally blown away. It's teal colored for those of you who are only listening to us.
It's a beautiful aqua, I would say.
Aqua, is it aqua?
Oh, yeah, I would call it aqua. Yeah.
It's aqua. Yeah.
Speaking of aqua is the name of a child of one of our colleagues. So I'm going to use this as a child segue. Have you talked to River about this book and how it's going to be in the library and bookstores? Like, does she have any thoughts on this?
She knows I'm a writer. She knows that books of mine exist. I think she's scribbled in one or two of them and then apologized and said, that's fine. I have like 20 of these. and I explained what author copies are. And she's asked me whether I'd ever write one for her. And, I got to get on that.
What did you say?
I said, I'll work on it. I don't know about you, but like I spend a lot of my time like writing creatively, I would say, like not like novels or anything like that.
You have closet novels. Don't pretend you don't have,
sure,
I know
okay,
about
but
your
like,
closet novels.
Yes, but,
I
but that having, them. But that having been said, that having been said, like, you know, I write essays, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
I have found it so hard to tell stories to that girl. Like I basically am like, oh shit, this is the total IP. I was like redoing The Hobbit with
so
squirrels
funny.
Or whatever. Right. Like my
and
mind
then
just goes
Wilbo
blank.
Wagons went on a journey.
Right? I'm like, what the fuck? I make stuff up for a living kind of. And like, here I am.
Children will humble you in that way.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You think you're good at storytelling and the children are just like, next, that
like,
one
why?
Sucked.
Why?
Yeah.
Why? And you're like, I don't know. Get off my case.
My sons are literally constantly trying to literally silence me. Like I'll just be like at the piano doing like a little messing around and they'll be like, mama. And I'm like, you're literally silencing me. This is going to take on more significance later.
Silent parent. A five-year-old is talking.
Jesus. Yes. Okay. Well, I can't wait to hear River's review of the book once it's in
print.
Yes. I have noticed with my own children that a way to make like the parent is a writer and that's their job, like legible, is being like, mama's book will be in the library. And then their jaws kind of drop because my kids
are
library
true.
Kids. Yeah.
My library book is in the library. It's true. Or maybe
it
I'll,
might
like,
be a good time, Adrian, to go into your local. You're what closest to what the Castro branch? You should pop into the SFPL and chat up some librarians about this book that you have coming
it's
out.
It's true.
Sir.
Get some talk around the water cooler. Well, everyone's talking about this book.
Listen, SFPL has power, man. I mean, I am frequently at the West Portal branch, the Noe Valley branch. Like, we make a tour of the branches. Those librarians are on the fucking ball, man. You should talk
absolutely,
to them.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And they but could I just host a local event with you, too. This is just me spitballing marketing.
Maybe. I mean, I feel very self-conscious about promoting my own book to professionals. It's like, have you ever bought your own book at a bookstore for someone? I've had to do this where, like, I was like,
I haven't done that. Like, that sounds roundly humiliating.
Yeah. And then they look at your credit card and, like, oh, and you're like, oh, it's go you. Fuck yourself, man. Like, I'm signing this for someone who asked for it. Like, I'm not like trying to seed, like, I'm not Tucker Carlsoning this and, like, just like buying my own book by the thousands.
Listen, let me drop a little gossip about bookstore readings. We had a friend of the pod, Vanessa Angelica Villarreal at Green Apple a couple weeks ago.
I know. I wanted to come and I couldn't do it.
It was not only just like such a fun discussion. She's such like a brilliant genius. That was delightful. We both wore our swords. But there was a whole packed house of people who neither of us knew personally. And I thought that was a real testament to Vanessa's internet power. Yes,
I missed it. I was gutted to miss it, but I missed it for the most appropriate reason for that book, which was it was my Dungeons and Dragons night. And I was like, I got to do it. Which is like, for those of you
listeners should know that there is like a secret Stanford Dungeons and Dragons Society, and it's not as like, it's not like cloak and dagger, like, you know, the shit that the Bushes did, but like there is a secret society and I know about it.
Wait, there is?
I thought there was. Didn't you tell me that this is what's isn't the is
no, it I just have a D&D game here.
It's what am like I thinking a... of that you have like a gathering with like Josh Landy and like other Stanford faculty?
Oh, Trivia Night.
Trivia Night. That's what I was mixing.
Stanford
up.
Okay. Trivia Night is huge.
That's the secret society. Yes. Oh,
yeah. No, it's not so you should come. I mean, we need
I've
people.
Never been invited, Adrian.
You're invited now. It's okay. It's absolutely it's delightful. And
what is the difference between trivia and history is a question I've always had. Like,
I wish it were more history. It's like they read from these trivia books, right? So like they're, you know, you're playing for free beer basically, which is nice. I mean, except for me, cause I don't drink.
I was going to say, you don't drink. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But still, I mean,
winning. You do like
you
winning.
You can get like a Diet Coke out of it. You know, I'm cheap. Or like some nachos, if need be. They're just like, you know, it's like music rounds and like movie lines and that kind of thing. It's quite fun.
Pop culture stuff.
Yeah, then you should come and help us win. We came in second the last time I went, and we were all quietly humiliated. Like no one looked each other in the eye.
I'm ready to bring you back to victory and triumph. Part of the reason I'm asking this is because my dad is a former history teacher. My mom is a former chemistry teacher. My mom is constantly roasting my dad for knowing all this like useless trivia. And I'm like, well, how useless is it? You know, some of this might just be like facts from history.
Well, at the last one, just to give you a sense of just like how it can be both, you can feel very proud of yourself, but also be like, oh my God, what have I done with my life?
Yes.
I argued with the whole table. I argued them down and I made them put a different, you do this as a group. And I said, we have to put this answer down because I know it's right. And they're like, how can you possibly know this? And it was recognizing the Jaquan song Tipsy from like 2003 or 2004.
Oh yeah.
From the first 15 bars. Everybody in the club.
I mean, like, everybody. Yeah.
It's like, oh my God, like how the fuck do I know this? And like, oh, like, you know, on the one hand, I was like very proud to get that point, but I was like, I gotta change my life, man. Like
that's a real completion moment of like your full Americanization. You know, this is a process that's been underway for like 20 plus years now. And moment really culminated.
What it turns out to be is like, it was a time in my life when I was driving in a lot of cars and I only had a radio. Yeah, I realized my knowledge of 2003, 2005, radio play stuff is surprisingly encyclopedic because I just like had, you know, whatever Philly station we were stuck on, like on all the time. That's all gone away. Basically, the moment Napster showed up, like all that went out the window.
Yeah, I had that experience recently with a friend bringing up a song by The Strokes, and I was just constantly like completely portaled back to 2002, which was my senior year in high school. And music has that capacity. There's actual research on how it does that.
It's true.
Do you know what's not trivial at all, and in fact deeply important, is Alexis Pauline.
I hear the tires screeching.
Oh my God. I mean, Alexis Pauline Gumbs on Audre Lorde is it's a titanic work. It is, I mean, yeah. I don't, it's what, like 400 pages, but like 300 of them are footnotes. Like, she did so much research on this book.
It's incredibly impressive. And it's for fans of biographies, it's a double treat in that, and I think we get into that a little bit in the questions, in that it basically gives you everything you want in a biography, but also takes the form for a really interesting spin.
Yes.
And so, like, yes, as someone who enjoys biographies but sometimes gets a little fatigued by them, I love this one so much because I'm like, oh wow, now so we're doing this, right? And like, so you both are intimate, as she says, and you are in touch with this very remarkable life and mm-hmm. this remarkable person and the remarkable people around her. But you're also kind of in touch with like what it means to narrate someone's lives, like in the plural, like how mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. How to make someone come alive. It's really just, and it's just gorgeously written. But I mean, like, I guess a lot of biographies are, but like this also just like formally is inventive and interesting and exciting. Like you're gonna be like, as a biography nerd, you kind of you it's enjoyable twice over, right? Mm-hmm. On a meta level of like just how the story is being told and then the story itself.
I am a biography nerd, and I really appreciated the formal inventions that you're mentioning here. I mean, I'm thinking of other big biographies from the last 10 or 20 years, and like Ron Chernow's Alexander Hamilton was like cultural earthquake like a decade ago. That's a fundamentally different approach to this.
Yeah.
She's taking like a very explosive approach to situating Lord in like geographical history. She does so much description of like New York of that era. She like Lord kind of lands right in the middle of the Harlem Renaissance. But she's so, I think what really distinguishes this biography is her attention to climate. And like, I would say her insistence on climate and what is happening in climate change, in environmental racism, in these conditions of Lord's upbringing. How does that connect today? I mean, one of the things I was thinking as I was reading this book is like that formal invention is such an interesting and explosive one that I think that only a writer of experience could take that on. You know, like this could never have been anyone's first book.
No, right.
But this is Alexis Pauline Gums, and it is very much not her first book.
Right.
And I really felt that mastery in like her handling the subject. Yeah.
Can I ask you, what's your favorite biography? Do you have a favorite?
Oh my God, that is a wonderful question. I love that question. Okay, what is the really cheap? I have a couple, and none of them are going to be like impressive or prestigious. One of them is Ginger Rogers' autobiography.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, autobiography is different, though, I would say.
Okay, like, that's a good point. I think I have stronger feelings about autobiographies.
Me too. Finish. Yeah, that's what I was asking. Yeah, sorry.
I read and reread that Ginger Rogers autobiography. I think it's just called My Life, like 6 times in elementary school. I don't know what it was. In terms of biographies, I mean, Malcolm X is a pretty significant one in my sort of intellectual history. There's definitely like that book has been complicated in the long view by like part like Alex Haley is a more controversial figure than he used to be.
Yeah.
But there's a really cheesy one about the Russian czars, Nicholas and Alexandra. Did you ever read one?
I have. Yeah. Is that
it's like a very readable book.
Is that, who is that? Is that Massey? No.
Yes, it is Massey. It's still on my shelf. Yes.
Yeah.
My dad, shout out to my history teacher dad for giving me that book. It's a good one.
Yeah, Massey is just like, that's like totally sort of classic storytelling, exactly the kind of
thing. It's very much like a potboiler. Like it was really page turning. And that's what I loved about it.
One that that has really stuck in my mind, even though I'm wondering whether I would look at it as kindly now, is have you ever read Black Sun?
Mm-mm.
Jeffrey Wolfe. It was I think re-released by New York Review Books a couple of years ago.
Interesting.
It's about Harry Crosby, sort of a scion of the J.P. Morgan family, maybe.
Okay.
But like it ends up, it's telling his story as like sort of driving up to kind of a murder suicide, and it's so. I don't know. I think who knows how I would reread it, but I remember it being beautifully written. And just again, a little bit like Survival is a Promise.
Hmm.
It's a book that where you can tell a writer with immense gifts taking their craft to a story that could be told far more conventionally, but that like really is enriched by someone really being deliberate about how to deliberate about how really to present it ethically and to present it you know, accurately, not just from the day to day, but like, why is any of this happening? Yeah. What's the, as you say, what's the climate? What's the atmosphere?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to read more biographies, I do want to point out, I just started reading a biography of Tom Gunn.
Do
you want to see if we can get the biographer on the pod?
Yeah, we have a podcast. We should invite that biographer. Let's do it.
Yeah. Are you a Tom Gunn fan?
Yeah, totally. Awesome. I was just thinking of another biography that I love that it took me a minute of warming up to remember. So I have a personal obsession with the scholar Carolyn Heilbrun, who was the first woman ever to be tenured in the English department at Columbia. She happened to die my freshman year there, and she wrote a series of popular mystery novels that I'm obsessed with.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God.
Amanda Cross is her pen name. I love those novels. They're like the best campus novels ever written for my money. But she wrote a biography of Gloria Steinem, like at the very end of Heilbrun's life, and Heilbrun was hand-selected by Steinem for this job. And I was thinking about it in relation to Gumm's On Lord, because one of the things that I love that Alexis Pauline Gumm's brings to bear on Lord is like the influence of her childhood and the particular influence of her parents is so richly connected in Survival as a Promise. I really connected with those characters. So too does Heilbrun do a lot of deep work on Steinem's childhood. And in fact, one of the most resonant facts of Steinem's whole biography is that her mother suffered from serious mental illness and like multiple suicide attempts and institutionalizations. And this is such a huge part of like Steinem's whole call to action towards feminism. And I've just always found that really beautiful and compelling. We could go on. We could. Yes. Do you think we could go on for days talking about books? It's possible. Do you ever worry about the AI scams and how much footage of your voice they now have to send your parents robocalls saying that you've just decapitated a pregnant woman and need $10,000 or something?
Well, now I am. It hadn't occurred to me. God damn it.
I have been sending my parents a lot of articles being like, please don't ever send money without like calling me back. Because it sounds like the scams are getting so sophisticated with the voice AI.
At the same time, we can talk about that some other time. But like, wouldn't they have to be able to associate your parents with your, I mean, like, it feels like a lot of extra steps.
It sure does. But, you know, that there's nothing we can't be afraid of these days. Anyway, we've gone pretty far afield. What's important is that you buy this book, Survival is a Promise, The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. And please enjoy our conversation with scholar and author Alexis Pauline Gumm's.
Enjoy.
Alexis, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, this book was such a gift, and I could describe it in so many ways, but I really want to hear you describe it. Like, what is the eternal life of Audre Lorde? Why is it urgent to write a biography now? How would you describe this book?
Well, I see this book as an intimate portal. I see it as a way for people to get close to Audre Lorde and to bring her close, really, to them, wherever they are in their life right now. And that's how I felt about it when I was writing it. I felt like I was making this house where I would go be with Audre Lorde, and then this like trying to make that house more accessible, beautiful, comfortable for everyone who would one day join us there. So now that day is coming soon, which I'm excited about, but it did feel that way, even with like the revisions and, you know, all that you do in a biography. Every time I entered that document, it did feel like, I was like, oh, this is where Audre and I get to be at home together. And so that's what I hope it feels like for readers. And I think it's so urgent because Audre Lorde is one of the thinkers that we really need to most listen to about what it means to be at home as this planet and our relationship, which is right now a relationship out of sync, a relationship of dominance, as if we are not, in fact, Earth, ourselves. And Audre Lorde really had a different view about that. And these are things she thought about since she was a kid and that she never stopped thinking or writing or talking about. But it's not actually how we've called on her as a guide before. I think that we've called on her as a guide to think about identity and difference. We've thought of her as a guide to think about, you know, the braveness of breaking silence and coming out and our multiplicity and being who we are. And that is also very important for this time and every time. But I think that this piece that doesn't separate any of that from what it is to be in this primary relationship that we have, which is as a living part of this living planet, is key. And so I wanted it to be clear how important that was to her, because we really are at an urgent place around that in our relationship to what it means to survive.
Yeah, one of the things you do so well and kind of insistently throughout the biography, and that strikes me as like kind of part and parcel of what a biographer does, but you do it differently, is sort of to insist on the climates that she exists in, right?
The wind! Yes!
Yeah, it's just like there are things, she's always already in certain situations beyond her control, but also sort of, as you say, makes her home in them or does not, right? Speaks or does not speak, listens for certain things or refuses certain things. And just as a framing device, that sounded seemed to me very, very effective.
I'm glad. I think that, you know, it speaks to what I was saying earlier. I wanted us to just be with Audrey. And so sometimes I felt, and I'm sure this is something I have in kinship with other biographies, I felt just like obsessed, you know, like what was the weather like the day she was born? You know, what was happening, you know, what was happening in her neighborhood? But those things are very relevant.
Yeah.
And
yes,
that those are the, especially for her early life, like the parts of her life that it's harder to, you know, I can't really interview somebody about it. Her parents have passed away, you know, like all of that. I just wanted to have as much detail as possible so that we could really feel like we were meeting her there.
Yeah.
And however, she really did pay attention to those things. You know, she was paying attention to this is the phase the moon is in, and this is what the stars are doing, and this is what's happening with, you know, the seismic dynamics, and these are what the rocks that I'm finding where I am are telling me about where I am right now. And she wrote about all of this in her poetry. And I think sometimes, you know, we read poetry and poets are talking about nature and we're like, oh, that's just a metaphor for how beautiful and complex our human relationships are. But for her, it was like, this is what our relationships are.
Yes.
Our relationships are a part of this. And it matters, you know, it matters if it rained all night before I'm walking in the garden with my partner, because we are actually part of this flood. And when I actually got that for myself, I was like, oh, okay, so to write a biography of this poet, I have to know. I have to know the geology, the meteorology, the astronomy. Like, I have to know those things that were lenses through which she was interpreting her life, because she understood that that was all part of what it was to be alive.
Yeah.
Were there any kind of biographies are one, I would say one of more, are more conventionalized forms of writing. And the way you're doing it, it's because of this kind of, you know, atmospheric approach. It's just, it's extremely open and extremely, as you say, welcoming. Are there quirks of that trade that you had to forego because of it, where you're basically like, you had that written down, you're like, oh, this doesn't fit, I got to take this out? Or is there enough space for even a pretty traditional biographic approach within what you were talking about? Or are there really things where you're like, no, this probably would distort what the project of this book is? Are there things you didn't do?
You know, I think what I tried to do, and in alignment with that openness that you talk about, I really tried... I wanted to create a space of wondering, because Audre Lorde was so curious, you know, and she wondered about everything. Like she would wonder about, you know, everything on your wall and on your bookshelf if she had lived in the time of video conferencing like we do. But the way you see it is that she's like being interviewed by somebody and she's like, what's that stone in your ring? You know, like she moves in close, but she's curious in a nonlinear way. And so I felt I also had to be curious in a nonlinear way and support the potential curiosity of the reader beyond what I could predict, right? So instead of being a biographer that's like, okay, well, all you need to know is this, because this is a story I'm telling you and this is a conclusion I'm bringing you to, I don't know really all what they need to know. You know, I wanted to put space in. So if there's someone who's like, well, I just want to follow this line around, you know, what did this feel like to her on a particular day? Or why did she go into phone booths and try to talk to her dead best friend? You know, like I want to keep going with the phone thing. You know, I allowed myself to go in those directions to exemplify that desire that I have for people to really just wonder even more about Audre Lorde as they read this book. And so I wouldn't say that there are like details I had to hold back, but I would say that my goal wasn't to create something that's like, okay, now you know. Mm-hmm. So stop wondering because this is it. And now move on to the next thing.
I am the authority. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to, I mean, sure. I think I'm sharing aspects of my expertise and obviously my obsession by sharing all these details about Audre Lorde's life. But the thing that I most want to transmit is I hope that other people can give themselves permission to be as curious about her as I am. So I wanted to write this in a way that would open things up. And I know that sometimes in a conventional biography, it's like, well, we want to just like, we want to close it down. We want, everyone wants their biography to be definitive. And I think that since my experience of Audre Lorde and my definition of her power has so much to do with wonder, that's what I had to prioritize. So my creative decisions prioritize that.
This really gets to something I really wanted to talk about. Like what Adrian is asking about, I think, is the choices you made as a biographer. And one of the things I hear you saying is, I chose expansiveness. I chose wandering and wondering. And like, there's a porousness to that approach. There's like, enter anywhere you want. There's so many doors. Enter wherever you want. And one of the virtues of that approach, in addition to just being an incredibly pleasurable reading experience for someone else who's obsessed with Audre Lorde, was you take us on a map of her influences, right? I mean, the way you write about her childhood is so deep and expansive and detailed. And that one of the functions of that detail is it introduces other names who are important but have been forgotten by the racist view of history, essentially. So to that effect, can you tell us on the record who is Augusta Braxton Baker and why is she significant here?
Oh my goodness.
I love her so much.
I love her too. I was telling a friend, I was like, I feel like I could write a biography of Augusta.
Yes, please. Yes.
It could be cool. Yeah.
Incredible figure. Yes.
Yeah. I'm excited because I'm scheming with the people at the Schomburg to do an event that really focuses on that part at the library, you know, where she and Audrey met each other. Yes. So
A historic site. Yes.
Yeah. So Augusta Braxton Baker was the children's librarian at what was then called the 135th Street branch, Harlem branch of the New York Public Library, when Audre Lorde was growing up. So Audrey's mother would take her and her sisters to library club. Audrey's parents both were really interested in their children's access to books, which, you know, turned out well. I don't think it turned out the way they expected necessarily, but it was very important. And so Augusta Braxton Baker was the daughter and granddaughter of storytellers from South Carolina. And she became a librarian, like she was so determined. You know, I write about the fact that, yeah, she had to apply 3 times for this job and they kept saying they lost her application and she didn't give up. And she was so committed to children's relationship to literature. She felt very strongly because she came out of an oral tradition that it was important to read out loud. And that's what she did for her library club. And she encouraged children to memorize poetry. She was reciting poems and stories and fables and myths. And the voice was really important to her as a pedagogical approach. And so she went on to really do huge things for children's literature. She ultimately became the head of the entire New York Public Library Children's Department, which she was the first division, Black division head of a department of the New York Public Library ever. She was chair of like the Newbery Medal and the American Library Association for Children. She wrote about how librarians and how parents and how teachers should approach literature in a way that honored the diversity of the children that they should be accountable to. And so I was researching about her life was really one of the gifts of doing this research. Audre Lorde writes about her and she talks about her in interviews. Audre credits the fact that she went on to get a degree in what was then called library services. We now call it library sciences at Columbia to the impact that Augusta Baker had on her. And yeah, it's so beautiful to see that really in Audre Lorde's first real job, she had so many jobs just trying to like live yes, in New York City yes. and, you know, make her life. But her first job that she was like, I'm in my profession. She was a youth librarian in Mount Vernon, and it meant so much to her to be able to pass on that impact that, you know, you just spoke earlier about open doors. She felt like books opened doors for her in such a transformative way. And she also was willing to do anything to open those doors for the youth that she was serving through the library, including bringing in extra things that went beyond the not very diverse curation of the library to make sure that the kids, that the Black kids in that community had things to read that could speak to them. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do imagine Augusta Baker thinking that, you know, maybe in her attention to children that she was creating future writers and maybe a future poet laureate of her own state one day. But I think that it's so beautiful to understand the impact of mm-hmm. librarians. And mm-hmm. yeah, I've had the opportunity to share with booksellers and librarians about this book. And it just feels like there's such a love and a commitment, but also, you know, we just talked about the openness, like, librarians are like, here, you should be able to access everything. Who knows what you're going to do
for free,
right?
For free. Yes.
And totally. I mean, what if one way I think about the book sometimes is like, this is a library of Audre Lorde, right?
Yeah.
It's like, mm-hmm. you know, each of the chapters is named after one of her poems. And it's like, you could just go there. And where will you go? I don't know. And the good news is that I don't know. Mm-hmm. But as you say, knowing that Audre Lorde reading was such an intimate, important practice in her childhood, I was like, I have to read the things that I know she read. You know, I have yeah. to read this yeah. edition of the nursery rhymes. I have to read, you know, the poets that she loved as a young person and really try to get inside what was she making her language mm-hmm. out of. Because of the sources that she held so close. And of course, there's, you know, this meta level on the fact that, you know, I was a relatively young person when I started holding her work so close. And I know the impact that holding a writer particularly close and making them a part of your own relationship to language, I know what that's like in my own way. So it was really yes. fun to imagine what did that mean for yeah. her. With the influences she had access to.
I was just going to say, you narrativized this. You did such a beautiful job recounting like the CV of Augusta Baker, which is so important. But equally important to me in the reading experience was just that narrative moment when she meets Audrey for the first time. The conditions mm-hmm. under which she meets Audrey is a tantruming, nonverbal child, yep. immensely frustrated by all of these forces that nobody can help her with. Mm-hmm. And a kind Black woman comes over to this tantruming child and says, "Would you like me to read you a story?" Like,
yes.
That is the rescue she provides so many of us. Like it is that exact action. And that's why it meant so much to me to read. Anyway, Adrian, please speak.
Yeah. I mean, I just, this also resonated with me on several levels. I mean, also, I mean, it's another kind of way in which this book speaks to our present moment, right? Like yes. it, in some yes. way, right. The question of openness is why our libraries are under attack, right? In the mm-hmm. end, it's not that right, the number of books being removed from American libraries are small. They're dropping the bucket when it comes to the whole institution and how much they hold. But it's about the principle of it. It's the idea what happens in that moment that Laura is talking about is that a child that for whom all this stuff wasn't supposed to be for, right? Like this wasn't her legacy. It wasn't her heritage. It wasn't her. Right, she was nonverbal, all this stuff. Like in that moment, the librarian makes it for her. And suddenly, like, you know, a gap opens up in language for someone new to speak and to mm-hmm. to lay hold of all this stuff. And as someone who I've studied the practice of memorizing and learning by heart poetry quite a bit, like that is a form for people who feel on the outside looking yes. in when it comes to some of these things, to lay hold of language and to sort of see that it can do things for them, which was exactly, I think, Audre Lorde's thing, right? Like she had to kind of arrive at a very unique relationship to language just because, you know, she basically was screaming for the first couple of years of her life. And it seems, right, that's the thing that people are afraid of. The fact that like other people will lay a different kind of hold on, you know, these books. It's not even what's in them. It's the fact that someone might do something with them that isn't what you thought they were supposed to make possible, right? I just thought that's one of those atmospheres, right? It's a human made atmosphere. It's not, you know, natural, but like mm-hmm. the kind of. And I mean, like, this is also a moment where Lorde is, I think, somewhat representative of other people of her generation, right? Like, where the library suddenly becomes this engine for accession, right, into letters, and which is why people are trying to slam that door shut mm-hmm. right now, real, real hard, right? So I thought that was just so great how all she did was walk in a building or get dropped off in a building. Right. And yet, like, the conditions were right for this kid's unique gifts with language to be activated by this remarkable person.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and as you say, the attacks against the libraries, I mean, on the funding level, right, like the span of time that they can actually be open, the support of librarians to work in their chosen careers. And as you mentioned, also the censorship and the banning of books, you know, Audre Lorde's father, as I mentioned, fought for her, even with her own mother, to be able to read banned books.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something that is so important about that. And for me, it connects to how this was what Audre Lorde wanted with her writing. She really wanted people to take it on and do things with it that she wouldn't have expected.
Yeah.
Yes.
She wasn't interested in like, read this so now you can know about me or be like me.
She was a portal. She was acting as a portal.
That's right. Yes. She was like, find your own transformation in this and take responsibility for the version of yourself that you find here. And yeah, I think that that's actually one of the ways that she kept being a librarian even after she stopped physically working at the library.
Yes. Okay, so also something I loved about this like grand tour through her life is like Audre Lorde is so deeply connected to other women poets and mm-hmm. believes so strongly in the principle of being connected to other women poets. So like, I mean, mid-century women poet gossip, Alexis, is just like my heart's desire. You know, like this is a very happy place for me. So I have my own opinions again, but who is your favorite friendship of Audre Lorde's? Like, who jumps out to you as resonant and significant to you in the relationships she had with other people we know? People we know in our hearts and our libraries, not like,
oh,
personally.
My gosh. It's so hard because
I know.
There's so much love there, you know?
I know.
The love.
That's why I wanted to ask an expert.
I know. The love between Audre Lorde and Pat Parker, like across the continent, I just, it brings me to tears every time I even try to, even editing that chapter. It's such a beautiful, crucial friendship for both of them.
Yes.
And like their persistence across like just the garble of what it means to not live anywhere near each other and only really have these few times in person. I mean, that's a beautiful one. Audre Lorde's friendship with Barbara Smith is so important. I mean, Barbara Smith is somebody who has nourished and mentored me so much. So that's also part of why I know what she made out of the way that Audre Lorde mentored and the way that their friendship was nourishing. She actually gave it to us. You know, like I feel like I'm a beneficiary very directly of how it was really that relationship with Barbara Smith. I mean, along with Akasha Hull and along with Beverly Smith, of course, and Demita Frazier, that group of people who were somewhat younger than Audre, that she really worked out how to make herself intergenerational, which is really what had to happen for her to reach me and to reach us and, you know, to be able to offer herself so intentionally, intergenerationally. It was really Barbara Smith who inspired her to do that and taught her how to do that, you know.
That's
and
beautiful.
Even in the struggles of what it is to be in close relationship and collaborative relationship and, you know, navigating toxic publishing industry and all that stuff. That is such a beautiful, beautiful relationship. And, you know, even though it's definitely a conflict that I write about in the book, the sisterhood between, oh gosh, there's so much. I mean, the sisterhood between Audre Lorde and Sonia Sanchez is one that is so huge, especially because it does come through a time when Sonia Sanchez is like specifically espousing a homophobic rhetoric. And then like really they stay in relationship in a way that allows them to evolve and be a model for talking about how to overcome homophobia in Black women's relationships. I think about the sisterhood between Audre Lorde and June Jordan, especially, even though it does have a tragic break in it that so breaks my heart because they really are two of the poets who've influenced me personally the very, very most. And they have so much in common and they knew that. But that one of the things I wanted to show, because there are some people who don't know, you know, they don't necessarily know that there was a conflict between Audre Lorde and June Jordan. And at a certain point they stopped speaking and stop collaborating directly. But the people who do know don't necessarily know or remember how much love there was there.
Yeah. And how important that is.
And what a loss, therefore, it was for them to be out of communication for decades, or for a decade. And so just that, you know, the sweetness, those letters, you know, I mean, I think that's the thing that it's so beautiful to experience as somebody who lives for archives and just like loves to dive into archives, is that you can see how people reached out to each other and how they supported each other and what words they chose to honor each other and draw each other close. And the fact that June Jordan returns to that, the form of the letter, but also to that tenderness that was in those early letters in her final tribute to Audre Lorde after Audre Lorde has passed away, is just like, you know, like it, to me, it shows that the love actually endured even when they had whatever boundary they had. or mm-hmm. just whatever, whatever it was that caused them to, after the conflict they had, not come back to each other and resolve it. There's a beauty in that too.
They had such similar childhoods, June Jordan yes. and Audre Lorde. And I worship June Jordan's childhood, the Soldier, a Poet's Memoir about her childhood. And there's just so much in common in the DNA of, they have these parents who are sort of alternately terrified and terrorizing, these parents who are both really hurt people and fiercely protective of their education and their right mm-hmm. to read. It's, you can see how they might not have had a conflict resolution mechanism.
Exactly.
In that childhood. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's also something to learn about just how much we want from people who have the most in common with us, you know. And this is something that Audre Lorde writes about in her essay Eye to Eye, some of which was inspired by conflicts with June Jordan, conflicts with Pat Parker, conflicts with other women in her life, close women and like random women, like the woman at the store, mm-hmm. or the post office. And I think that that's something, I mean, that is one of the life lessons that I really do take into myself. Like when I find mm-hmm. myself being like, why didn't she do that? You know, like I would have done that. And what is she thinking? And I'm like, oh, I do that too. When I find myself like annoyed and upset and really critical of someone else, every time I look at it, I'm like, this person has so much in common with me.
It's, you know, a mirror. And it really again.
Is, it's a mirror, right? It's really something that has to do with my unreasonable expectations of myself that, you know, I project onto other people and don't recognize that that's what I'm doing. And
can you stop personally assassinating me?
You know what I'm saying?
Like, God, do I know what you're saying?
This is what we do. And I think that that was another reason why, even though, like, you know, I just like wish that I could write, you know, some fantasy where, you know, close people who are just so powerful and so full of love and so intent on changing the world for the better, like could always reconcile whatever their disagreements were. Mm. When it's really passionate people, sometimes, you know, that doesn't happen. And sometimes people do say things or write things that they can't take back. And I don't want to do that. You know, I don't want to push away the people who I have so much to learn from, exactly because they remind me so much of myself that it triggers me. And so I hope that, you know, people who read this can take it. I mean, they can grieve with me because it's something I have grief over in terms of that history. But I hope they can also think about, you know, what would it mean? It really is a way of being kinder to ourselves. You know, like what would it mean to really just like take that breath, you know? Mm-hmm. Because there was so much love there. And I honestly think if either of them had really picked up the phone, you know, they yeah. could have, they could have had the support of each other in each other's lives when there are few people who could have understand what each of those women experienced than each other.
But in some way that makes it even more understandable, right? Like if, mm-hmm. This is one thing, you know, I thought about, you know, your metaphors of atmospherics are usually quite expansive, but sometimes one's atmosphere can be very, very small. And if there something's off, then it's just feels like, you know, a limb being cut from you. And the fact that someone would, like, I don't even want to say use the word overreact. How do you react at that point, right? Like, it's just, if, and I guess I'm thinking here of something also, you know, like the Kombehi statement, right? Like, basically, right, like, when the people who are there for you are kind of, when it's kind of a limited group, then then they have to be in your corner. And if they're not, like, yeah, that's gonna lead to hurt much faster than if you're like, oh, we're both famous authors. How curious, you know, ta, you know, it's you're just in a very like it in some way, like the intimacy that comes with that is, of course, one that not only can be disappointed, but is going to be disappointed, right? Like, you're not going to be there for each other the way you need to be. And I thought that that came through beautifully, that, like, in some way, it's not that these things were inevitable. They were, if anything, super evitable, it seems to me. As you say, you could have picked up a phone. But in some way, like, there was something so pressure charged about these relationships that, like, yeah, the chance of something doing it was pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it brings us back to that, you know, one of Audre Lorde's key terms is survival. And I think that what Audre Lorde and June Jordan, we know, because they have written about it as children, what they had to do to survive was to really face, you know, not having what they felt they needed, not feeling safe, feeling attacked, actually being attacked.
Yes.
And we do recreate that. We do recreate that in those relationships that we bring closest, our chosen family. You know, a sister is not like a metaphor, you know.
An unloaded term either.
It is a very, and what it means when we are children, it is a matter of life or death, whether the people closest to us are there for us or not. We are not able to survive on our own, right? We're not actually even individuals in that way. And that does remain true. We do continue to need each other. And sometimes I'm dealing with the visceral understanding that this is a survival question. And, you know, it's sometimes hard to go ahead and take that breath and let go of the adrenaline and be like, okay, but maybe I'm not going to actually die if someone disagrees with my approach or has a different approach from me or doesn't do what I really wish they would do. Maybe I'll be okay enough to understand that they too have their own journey that they're on, and they too have their own reasons that they're doing what they're doing. It's a lot to ask, you know, but I think that it is one of the possibilities that Audre offers. It's something that she thinks about in her writing. And I think that for me, telling the story of this loss in her life that was related to exactly that, that's part of what's at stake in our expansive relationship to each other, in the generosity of wonder that I want to bring to Audre Lorde, but it's like our practicum for bringing it to each other.
Yeah.
You know, I should wonder about you. If you're saying something that I'm like, how could she say that? My curiosity could be really helpful. Like, well, how could she say that? Like, what are the conditions actually that lead someone to say something that's so seemingly unimaginable to me? Mm. And yeah, I think our curiosity, whether, you know, I feel like it's Audre's curiosity, it's all of our curiosity, it's the collective curiosity, is something that can really help. And especially that we need when we face circumstances that we don't know how to face, and when we have to do things that are not the things we've done before, because the things that we've done before are destroying our relationship with Earth and with each other, predictably.
I mean, this gets to something, Alexis, that I think about all the time, which is that I often think that one of the biggest social obstacles to the kind of feminist unity that actually moves the dial is the way women are socialized to avoid, fear, and sublimate conflict and confrontation. Mm-hmm. And like, white women are the single worst at this. We are socialized from birth in a specific way to avoid and fear confrontation and conflict. But so much of what you're saying gets to how productive and illuminating conflict and confrontation are. Like, so there's so much to learn in the disagreement between June Jordan and Audre Lorde that they couldn't reconcile. And it's like, there's a turning away from this really powerful life force that I think is essential. And Audre Lorde is such, I just love what a fractious child she is, you know, sort of like in opposition to this socializing force. Like, she is uncontainable. Like, she is a bad kid, capital B, capital K. Mm-hmm. And you just see the origins of a really distinctive kind of gutsiness in that. I don't know if there's a question attached to that. I just love it. Like, I love the portrait of her that you show us and how that connects to that whole conflict. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, she goes there, and she did feel like
she goes there.
If it's important, if you're important to me, she knew what she felt was important, and she felt like she should bring it up, right? She was definitely not, I mean, I won't say that she was never conflict avoidant. I think that sometimes she may have felt like even not safe enough to really,
yes, of course,
you know, engage every single
legitimately so, yes.
And you have to make those decisions, right? And, you know, she talks about self-preservation, but I mean, there's so many of her friendships that she's like, you know, this might make you mad at me for a little while, but like, this is really what I see here. And yeah, I think we could really learn something.
But it's important to me to say it anyway. Yes, exactly. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I think that is huge. And, you know, especially when we really need to collaborate, we really need to do things together. You know, like, we're not, we have this potential illusion that, one, there's just infinite possible collaborators, and that the people who make us angry are just like some figure on a computer, you know, some yeah, figure
nameless, faceless, subhuman.
And,
yeah.
It's not true. We really lose our aliveness in thinking about life that way. And, you know, it's, I mean, I can't say, you know, I can't say that I live up to Audre Lorde's standard of confrontation. You know, I mean, I know we all really struggle with conflict, and I'm like, I don't know. I think that to be willing to risk whatever semblance of peace we think we've found comes from this knowledge that fake peace is actually toxic and dangerous and poisonous and can be deadly. Like, pretending it's okay when it's not okay. And this is something that, you know, Audre learns in such a hard way. You know, she held silence, you know, for her friend who was plotting her own suicide. And she wanted things to become okay by not making waves, right? By holding the space of supposed peace where her friend would still be honest with her about her plans. But it didn't lead to peace. You know, it's not to say, of course, it wasn't Audre's fault. And the horrible thing is that she really did blame herself, though. And that was very traumatic for her as a teenager. But I think that one of the things that she held very closely, like, mm-hmm. what I don't say. And my own fantasy that if I pretend like things are okay, they will be okay. She was not willing to pay those costs anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah. And of course, she did so much work to make us collectively aware of the costs of silence.
What was the hardest thing about writing this book for you? I imagine there must have been so much joy and connection in this process, but like, this is a dense and challenging book about a dense and challenging person. Like, where were the low parts for you, and like, how did you work through them?
I mean, honestly, the footnotes, I don't know, you know.
Like, God almighty, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh, you know, footnotes, permissions, you know, that piece of it, I feel really grateful that I had the support of an incredible emerging Audre Lorde scholar, Olivia Polk, who was my editorial assistant, because, honey, we would still not be done if I had to do this by myself. I was very challenged by that. But beyond the logistics, the challenge of the logistics of like a text that is so... that is so dependent on interviews and archival sources. And
sourcing, yeah.
All sorts of sources. I think what was most rigorous about this was Audre Lorde has this ethic where, you know, like I was saying earlier, she's like, it's still about you. And so I'm writing this and, you know, I mean, I show up a little bit in it, but of course it's not like my memoir mm-hmm. of my relationship to Audre Lorde by any means, but she just like would not let me off the hook. You know, it was like, yeah, if you want to write deeply about my grief, about my father's death, you know, it's like, you got to go there with your own feelings about, you know, my father passed away before I started writing this. And if I really want to look at, her feeling of accountability to this planet, I have to look at like survival as a promise. How am I breaking that promise? You know, where like I have to, well, I believe that I have to honor what I understand her approach to be, stay in it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in a way, that is part of the methodology. Like, you know, I'm creating this beautiful space to be in Audre Lorde, in Audre Lorde home, where she can like look me in my face and be like, you're not going to look at that?
And destroy you. Yeah.
Right. And be like, okay, like very soft, you know, plush rugs on this floor where I fall apart and have to put myself back together. And, but it's so rewarding. Like, it's so rewarding to allow ourselves to be transformed by a poet with such a rigor for herself. You know, like reading all of her journals, she was really rigorous with herself and her standard for how she would show up for her community, how she would show up for her kids, how she would show up in relationship. It would be easier, but then in my opinion, not worthwhile at all to like write about someone who just let themselves off the hook all the time and just made pretty images or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
That probably would be
more
faster.
Straightforward project. Yeah.
But what's the point of that? Right. So
yeah,
that was hard. And you know, there were days where it was like, it's all I could do to write this one sentence, you know, because like, because I'm in tears and because it holds me accountable as much as it holds any other reader accountable. It even, I mean, it even came up, I am the voice of the audiobook. And so even in recording the audiobook, it was like, this is part of my own poetic rigor. The vibration, the sound mm-hmm. of the words, the rhythm of the sentences, all of that is very important to me because it's doing work beyond what the words are doing. And being in basically an echo chamber, you know, I'm hearing myself in headphones, I'm in this womb recording studio space, and I can feel these words going to the places of my body, going to the places of my mm-hmm. personal history that need to be transformed. And just, you know, to keep letting that come through. It's, yeah, I'll use the word rigor. It's part of what was hardest. It's part of what I'm most grateful for. Honestly, it's part of what I'm most proud of myself for.
Yeah.
Of not turning away from the healing that this project required for me and the growth that it required of me, because I think that possible growth in the people who read it, that's the thing that really honors Audre Lorde.
That's so beautifully put. And I mean, it's also so moving, right? There is, again, I don't want to stereotype the sort of traditional task of the biographer. I mean, the biographers routinely, I would imagine, see themselves as participating in the same process that their readers later participate in. On the other hand, right, the category of openness is so important here again, that in some way you put yourself through a process that you then put your reader through, and in some way that's the pedagogy of the book. And that's not, I don't think that's true of every biography. That's
I
not,
agree.
I mean, it can come with the best ones, but that's not necessarily what happens, you know. And so I guess that's just a long-winded way of saying, like, thank you for putting yourself and us through it. That's
for
the thing.
For that rigor,
exactly. I think it, the poetic rigor that you speak of, you know, it comes through in every sentence, and at the same time, it kind of exhorts us to have it too, to display it mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and my hope is that I think actually this is just what's required. Like, I just have to put enough love in there that we can go through what we need to go through, you know,
right.
Like that.
Yeah.
Like, I had to do that for myself, right? I had to feel like I'm coming into a space of love every time I open the document, and I want people to feel that. And I do think that that was part of Audre Lorde's pedagogy too. Like, people felt so profoundly loved, and they felt like she was really going to hold them accountable, but like, it was possible because it really was an embrace. And, yeah, I think that that's important too, because I think that, you know, we have this urgency. We need the world to change. Like, there's a way that I think I could write my insistence on some of the lessons that Audre Lorde has taught that we as a collective have still not taken up as much as we need to. It could be a prodding. It could be a poking. It could be like, you know, like, I got you. And like, I'm shaking.
Wake
you
up, sheeple. Yeah.
This, you know,
come on, you guys.
But like, who, you won't stay, like, you won't stay. And I know that the way I respond to that type of pressure is I shut down and I can't learn anything new. And I just have to try to remember how to like protect myself. And that's not the most generative space. And so.
Her favorite word, generative.
Generative. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's the standard.
I mean, that's something that maybe we should have mentioned at the beginning, that the book starts really with Audre Lorde kind of thinking or embodying her own afterlife, her own legacy.
Her first funeral. Yeah.
We attend her first funeral
with her.
It's very interesting to think about how I recently reread the Sontag book on illness and its metaphors, and like, those are both very moving reactions to in one case potentially fatal, and the other one a fatal disease, but they're so different, right? One is about this analytic question of what people see when they look at you, and that is the thing that Lorde doesn't seem interested in at all, right? Like, that is just not the space she's speaking from. And so therefore it's really about like kind of a grieving process while you're still alive, about a process of sort of maintaining life after death. It's about, you know, what legacy, about the charge you leave to those around you, but also it's kind of the joy and humor in the situation. And to me, that just like, I mean, it's a kind of facile comparison. I'm sure others have made it, but I do think it is telling, and it's great that you open with that, because it is exactly that. It's like, in some way, the question of why another biography of this poet 40 years later answers itself in those scenes, because you're like, oh, okay, because she didn't want us to be done with her, right? And like, and that is a call that will find its echo again and again and again, and we have to sound out that echo from time to time and say, how is it speaking to us now? How is it addressing us now? How is it calling us out now? And I think that to me was a perfect opening and a perfect, like, it explained the assignment to me beautifully. I'm like, okay, this book is homework to some extent, a very pleasant homework, but homework nonetheless. And I'm ready for it. I want to do this. I want to do right by it.
I mean, as you're talking, what I'm thinking is like, what is more lovingly accountable and like devastating to offer the world than the metric that everybody should hold themselves to the standard? It feels right to me. You know, oh God, Audrey, you know, like that's both devastating and beautiful. Like, it's
yikes,
so hard.
I gotta change
beautiful.
My life.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds so simple. And, you know, she shows us over and over again that like, you have to fight for that. You know, I mean, she.
Every day.
With her medical journey, what her doctors were telling her didn't feel right to her. She had to, like, the amount of research that she had to do to even find the alternatives that then she had to leave the United States to access. I just think that that's something that's so important. Any of us who've tried to live up to this, it feels right to me.
There's nothing convenient in it.
Yeah, we immediately see how we're in a society that's like, that feels so wrong at so many access points to our experience, and how much we have to change our own lives, our relationships to each other, but our systems that are systemically producing this, you know, dis-ease, as she would think about it, this profound feeling of not rightness. And yeah, I think that it's a beautiful thing that, and the reason that I start with her first funeral is because, I mean, it's one of the things about, I mean, it's her prolonged journey with cancer. But her prolonged journey with cancer is even prolonged because she decides to live with cancer.
She fights
longer than anybody on her, you know, first medical team could have predicted. And so she's thinking about her mortality, but she's being in community at the same time for years, you know, and she's actually able to teach her community how to memorialize her because, one, she's willing to talk about her illness, her disability, her chronic experience, right? In a way that some people, they make the decision that no one's going to even know that they're sick because they don't want someone to look at them as a sick person, and they don't want to have to manage other people's reactions and fears and all of that, right? And it's not a judgment. It's just that because in my work, I must honor Audre Lorde, this is profound. And when you then understand her childhood, you see that it's like, oh, she's living through world wars.
Yeah.
In a society where people are like, we're okay, we're okay. But she knows, because she's reading in the newspapers, that there's people are dying by suicide or almost dying by suicide over and over and over again. The suicide rates during World War II and after World War II, the whole actual World War period, are profound. You know, she's like Alfred, you know, the kid at school dies and the people cover it over.
That part was devastating to me. Yes.
Wow. Yeah. And so her relationship to break what is one of the biggest silences we have about our mortality, about death and dying, it's just one of her hugest victories.
Yes.
And so that's part of why I really wanted to start there, because that's why it's an eternal life. You know, this approach to life that can actually include our own deaths and our process of facing that and facing it together. I mean, for a species that doesn't want to talk about its own extinction practices for its own self, right? What an example. So yeah, thank you for deciding to participate in the process of Audre Lorde's ongoing funeral, which is how we continue to honor her.
What an honor.
Part of her afterlife.
Yes. What absolute an honor. Okay. I think we have to let you go so you can write your Augusta Braxton Baker book like as soon as possible and let us know so we can talk about it. But my last question is, you do such a beautifully panoscopic job of giving us a portrait of Audrey at every age. And here's what's important about when she was six. And here's what's important about her high school at Hunter College. Like, if you could tell 12-year-old Alexis or 14-year-old Alexis or whichever Alexis held Audrey in her hands for the first time, like, what would that Alexis think of this accomplishment? Like, how does that Alexis feel in this moment?
Oh my gosh, she is losing it. Like,
yes!
She's very present. She's showing up. I mean, you know, I got like my author's copies and it's just like, what? Just the gratitude.
Mm.
It's really an overwhelming feeling of gratitude. Because it's almost like from here, I can see everything that Audre Lorde's life, legacy, and work was giving me then. And through the process of writing this book, I kept thinking about the fact that, you know, starting from 14, which is when I first started reading Audre Lorde, I always had Audre Lorde as a reference point. And Audre Lorde did not have Audre Lorde as a reference point, except she did. She had current time. She had 14-year-old Audre Lorde as a reference point. And I had the full scale of her life as a reference point and what it meant to have that and really being able to see the contrast of what it was to not have that, but to know it needed to exist and be carried forward. I just, so my 14-year-old self is celebrating, like is absolutely celebrating and is humbled by what it means. I mean, the reality is that there's not a version of myself that I can imagine without the impact that Audre Lorde has had on my life. And so when we talk about the atmospheric, when we talk about the conditions of existence, these are my conditions of existence.
She's one of them. Yeah.
I sometimes say I have the best problem. You know, I have like, I'm so overwhelmed by gratitude. I have this gratitude I'm never going to be able to fully express at all. And that is a really good problem to have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were people who, including the people at Caris Bookstore who first told me about Audre Lorde, there were people who knew I would need Audre Lorde for reasons I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. And there's been such a generosity of the people who loved her and who benefited from her life and her students and her mentees who have taught me and who have mentored me. This is like a very long acknowledgement section of this book.
I loved it.
It gives me anxiety because I'm always thinking of more gratitude that I want to give that's not there. And now it's impressive, whatever. So all that is to say, gratitude is the word. And I really am holding hands with that 14-year-old and I'm thanking her because she said, this is important. I'm holding on to this. I'm never letting this go. I mean, this is the book that 14-year-old held that is now falling apart because I never let it go and I touch it every single day. And that is my 14-year-old self gift to me. I'm so grateful.
The Feminist Present is a production of the Michelle R. Clayman Institute for Gender Research. The co-hosts are Adrian Daub and Laura Good. This podcast is produced by Ana de Almeida Almiral. We are especially grateful to our feminist colleagues, Allison Bell Crossley, Jennifer Portillo, Cynthia Newberry, Leah Gottlieb, Bethany J. Nichols, Jessica Lopez, Susan Krieger, Argavon Salas, and Moira Donegan.